you're saying there's an in-between setting? The problem when it's dark is with my sleep. My preference would be to leave it bright as long as it's getting it to be full screen rather than showing all the stuff around
it. Yeah, that was what I was hoping to do because I'm not, like, originally they were,
I think, click play slideshow. I think maybe that one. Yeah.
I think I just...
Yeah, no, I don't need to see it.
And then that thing with the power, so I can probably plug your, you want it plugged in.
It's plugged into a power strip underneath there.
But I'll need it over at the projecting spot.
Where's the projector?
See that funny platform with the cords?
Oh, I didn't understand that.
Because I'm pretty sure, because the computer has to actually connect.
Oh, okay. All right, yes. And then take it and bring it to your spot. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to let you know that we have a slight technical glitch, and so it's going to be a few more minutes. So if you need to make a restroom stop or grab some water, we'll start as soon as we can.
data on slides, but I'll just read it.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. This is room 251, and this is the Sophia Foss lecture. I just want to make sure everybody's in the right place. We are having a couple of technical issues, but we've decided to plow ahead in the old-fashioned way without pretty pictures and that kind of thing. So thank you very much for your patience. I'm Dana Regan, and I'm one of your Laredo board members. And on behalf of the Liberal Religious Educators Association, I want to welcome you to the Sophia Foss Lecture. The Foss Lecture is named in honor of Sophia Lyon Foss, who, in the middle of the 20th century, shaped the course of Unitarian Universalist religious education. Her insights, including the notion that children develop religious understanding from their interaction with the world, revolutionized how we teach. Since 1974, the Foss Lecture Group has invited an individual whose life and work shows a commitment to and understanding of the meaning, depth, and challenges of liberal religious education. And this year, the choice is a fine one. I'm proud to introduce the 2015 Sophia Foss Lecturer, journalist Susan Katz Miller. Susan is a former reporter for Newsweek and New Scientist. During years based in West Africa, Brazil, and the United States, she has written for the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and numerous other publications. Her book, Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family, based on original surveys and reporting, was published by Beacon Press in 2013. Since then, her work on interfaith families has been featured in Time, Slate, Salon, Utney Reader, NPR, The Today Show, and many other media outlets. She has spent the past 2 years speaking at universities, churches, synagogues, and community centers, working for a deeper understanding of families who choose to celebrate more than one religion and who want interfaith education for their interfaith children. Forging alliances with a variety of faith traditions is crucial in our complex 21st century global community. Susan makes a compelling argument about the need for including, not excluding, people who choose an interfaith belief system. Interfaith families are adept at collaboration and cooperation. There is much to learn from her work. Susan is available afterward to sign her book, which will be offered for sale in the back of the room. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Susan Katz Miller.
Thank you, Dana. So, on a glorious October day almost 30 years ago, I walked around Walden Pond with a group of friends who'd converged on our little New England town for my wedding. We strolled under a canopy of green and gold and red leaves, which you'll have to imagine, which was supposed to be on the screen here. Discussing Thoreau and transcendentalism. The next day, I stood in my backyard reciting marriage vows in front of a rabbi and a minister. And the day after that, I got on a plane and I moved to West Africa. Now, at that point, I was suffering from a bit of cultural whiplash. I was really a bit of a mess, and I was asking myself why I had left a prestigious job at Newsweek to move to a new continent and, frankly, follow my husband. I was struggling to step into my new role as a nice half-Jewish girl married to a Protestant boy working for a Catholic organization in a Sufi Muslim country. Well, after about 3 years, I had kind of gotten the hang of it, and I was expanding my identity to include a lot of new formative experiences. And just about that time, we moved to northeastern Brazil. And there, I encountered the descendants of Portuguese Catholics and West Africans and indigenous peoples of Brazil who came together to practice traditions based on the Yoruba culture of West Africa. I remember strolling barefoot down to the seashore with my small toddler daughter holding my hand as we threw white flowers out into the waves in a ritual for the sea goddess Yamanjá. Now, this is something that in Brazil is not considered cultural misappropriation. It's considered an acknowledgement of the importance of West African religions to all Brazilians. It's a very mixed culture. I tell you these stories because ultimately my years in the religious complexity, fluidity, and flexibility of West Africa and Brazil helped to inspire me to make the decision to give our interfaith children an interfaith education rather than choosing a single monofaith identity for them. It also inspired me to become an advocate for the idea that religious institutions, in order to survive, can and must adapt to our multi-faith reality. We need religious institutions to recognize that love leaps across boundaries, whether those are boundaries of race or ethnicity or gender or class or religion. I also want to say that it's a great joy for me to be here today in front of a Unitarian Universalist audience. And I want to thank Loretta for inviting me to have this conversation with you. Because yous, more than any other religious movement in America, already understand how each of us creates and recreates our own religious pathways. Theologian Forrest Church once wrote, "Unitarian Universalists are neither a chosen people nor a people whose choices are made for them by theological authorities, ancient or otherwise. We are a people who choose." This emphasis on choice deeply resonates with those of us who have chosen interfaith education for our interfaith children, whether we are UUs or members of intentional interfaith family communities like mine. I'm going to tell you a little bit about those today. The interfaith families community movement was created by and for interfaith families in order to teach children about both Judaism and Christianity in equal measures. I see it as a parallel, kind of a cousin in many ways to Unitarian Universalism, and it is certainly inspired in many ways by UUism. And that's in the sense that we do not impose a creed or a dogma on children, but instead support them in their own faith or worldview formation. And to be frank, it's a little bit disorienting for me to preach to such a warm and welcoming choir with UUs, because since the publication of my book, which has been very controversial with a lot of more traditional religious audiences, I've given a lot of talks to very skeptical audiences, people who had to really wrestle with the idea that there are benefits and not just challenges to being part of an interfaith family, people who had to wrestle with the idea that interfaith education is good for children, interfaith children and all children, and isn't going to just screw them up and confuse them. And people who really felt taken aback by my unapologetic exhilaration at the idea that religious communities are converging and intertwining and reformulating in the 21st century. So, I deeply appreciate that Unitarian Universalism, more than any other organized and widespread religious movement, welcomes each of us in all of our complexity. I am fairly sure that we have Italian, Irish, queer, Christian, mystic UUs here today. Anybody? Yeah. How about mixed race pagan UUs? Yeah? Probably got a whole banner for that in the parade, right? And I know we have a whole passel of Jubutarians. Definitely. Chala. And yet, so this concludes the portion of the talk where I praise you lavishly. And yet, the task of learning from people who have these complex religious identities and who are from interfaith families has really only just begun. So yesterday, I got to interact with the religious educators at Laredo's Professional Day. And we talked about being open to the idea that it is possible to, on the one hand, deepen your Unitarian Universalist identity, and at the same time, affirm and draw on the enriching Unitarian Universalist reality of extended interfaith families. We can do both. It's a both-and situation, not an either-or situation. We talked about supporting UUs who draw strength and creativity and inspiration from Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, pagan, secular, humanist, and other worldviews, rather than having to leave those worldviews behind in order to have a UU identity. So today we're going to spend a minute looking at, although we're not going to see it, so in our minds, considering some of the big picture. And I'm going to, I guess, read to you a little bit of data. It's probably a relief not to have to look at those busy slides. But we're going to look at the national context. Okay, now you're going to have to picture a slide where we have four interacting circles and arrows leading in all directions. It's probably better not to look at this. and what this is showing is interfaith marriage, which is increasing, and we'll talk about that data in a minute. Global interconnectivity, especially among millennials. Millennials are aware of and have access to basically infinite forms of religious identity now, and they're aware of religions across the world, and they're taking that and forming DIY, do-it-yourself, complex religious identities. They're also, and we have statistics on this from Pew, disassociating from traditional religious communities in large numbers. And they're interfaith marrying at a higher rate. And the arrows go in all directions because if you're intermarried, you are more likely to disassociate from any religious institution that doesn't accept your interfaith marriage, and there's a lot of them. And if you're already disassociated, you're more likely to have an interfaith marriage because there's nobody telling you you can't do it. So there's a synergy there. Now, traditional religious institutions, when they look at this kind of feedback loop, they find it very scary because they perceive of this as a downward spiral leading away from religion. But instead, I see the intersection and overlap of religions happening in a fertile tidal zone. That's the way I think of it, enriched by the ebb and flow of different religions. It's a zone, oh, hey, look at that. Is there the little remote thing to make it go? Yay. Okay, we're working on it. So in this tidal zone, there are waves that are knocking down old idols and icons, and sometimes those waves temporarily knock the breath out of people who were trying to kind of dig in and stand in one place, and the waves aren't letting them. But those waves also create energy, and they carry nutrients and diverse life. And a lot of us are surfing in this liminal zone, exhilarated by the churn. And as surfers, we could be described as theological Unitarian Universalists, whether or not we are official members, whether or not we are even aware that there is such a thing as Unitarian Universalism. So, next slide. Do you have the ability to go to the next one now? Oh, there we go, yeah. So in a few minutes, we're gonna look at some of the data and research supporting these diagrams, but the question posed by them is, what do they mean for communities that could provide spiritual homes for interfaith families, for the spiritual but not religious, and for religious nuns, N-O-N-E, which are overlapping communities or categories? And I'm gonna suggest that we all need to listen more carefully to the stories being told by those who feel disconnected from even the most liberal religious communities, yours and mine. And we also need to listen to those with complex religious identities from within our own communities who offer loving critiques and suggestions for new ways forward. And today I want to challenge you to go beyond tolerating or accepting interfaith families and people with complex religious identities and suggest that it is time to affirm and lift up those identities as an important historical, present, and future source of creative energy at the very core of the 21st century experience. Next, there we are. How did you know? Now, as I know you're probably aware, Skinner House has been publishing an important series of books filled with the stories of those with complex identities, including Buddhist voices and Jewish voices in UUism. And some of these voices describe how white, colonial, Christian, heteronormative privilege can continue to present challenges for those who might benefit tremendously from everything that UUism has to offer. At the same time, they describe the historic role of Unitarian Universalism in pioneering radical inclusivity. In the Jewish Voices book, UU minister Rob Eller Isaacs writes, "One of the great strengths of our tradition is that we affirm each person's right and responsibility to construct their own identity." So, in the interest of full disclosure, and if you'll indulge me, I'm going to return to the story of how I constructed my own identity so that you know where I'm coming from as a kind of UU ally and fellow traveler. Recently, I had the opportunity to give an interfaith identity manifesto of sorts at Union Theological Seminary in the James Chapel. And Sophia Foss was one of the first women on the staff there, so that's a kind of a nice resonance. But here is my identity statement. It works. I am not a half-Jew, a half-Christian, a half-anybody, a half-anything. I will not be fractionated, intersected, unraveled, disentwined, dissected. I am whole. But yes, as Walt Whitman declared, I contain multitudes. I contain the rich harmony of Protestant hymns. I contain the minor melodies of Jewish song. I hold and embrace the cognitive dissonance of my theological family. I claim my Irish ancestor who started out Catholic in the old world and somehow ended up Protestant in the new world. I claim my teetotaling Scottish ancestor who somehow justified importing whiskey to America. I claim my great-grandfather, an itinerant rabbi on the Mississippi River in Natchez and New Orleans. And I claim my mother, a comparative religion major who wanted to be an Episcopal priest but had the wrong gender for that time, and went on to marry my Jewish father. I do not fear syncretism, for I know the history of every religion is syncretic. But I prefer instead to talk about synergy. Synergy from the Greek literally means working together, not blending or blurring or melting into a new identity. My identity is synergistic, producing energy that fuels my passion for interfaith peace. It's more than the sum of its parts. It's a geometric architecture taking me to heights of claiming space. I claim bell towers and soaring cathedrals. I claim the angular superimposed triangles of the Star of David. And I claim the ancient domes, blue and gold and white, of my multiple religious origins in Jerusalem. I see my role, the role of an interfaith child, as bridge builder, ambassador, peacemaker. What we talk about when we talk about interfaith families is love, the idea that love can prevail. We're talking about building peace on the single family level, but also on a broad scale, because internationally, the acceptance of interfaith families is a social justice issue. Around the world, in countries that don't have civil marriage, in states where religious institutions control the right to marriage, we're still fighting for legal permission to love and marry across the lines of faith. And so, alongside our LGBTQ allies, we are standing on the side of love. You see what I did there? I appropriated your most excellent UU tagline. Because it's particularly relevant to those of us from interfaith families, which is almost all of us these days, right? But I'm going to back up a generation to explain how I came to my own Jewish and interfaith identity. My Jewish father there turned 91 this month, and my Episcopalian mother is 84. They married in 1960, and more than 55 years later, they still have one of the strongest marriages I've ever encountered. And I think my experience as part of a happy three-generation interfaith family really has colored my approach. It's inspired me to resist the dominant discourse that said, interfaith marriage is a problem. Now, at the urging of every clergy member they consulted, my parents did choose one religion for their children, and the religion they chose was Judaism. I don't know if you can see, but that's me in the back and my siblings lighting a Hanukkah menorah. And I think that my parents made an excellent choice. Judaism is a choice that works for a lot of Jewish and Christian interfaith families, but not all of them. So what I write about in the book is the idea that any choice you make as an interfaith family, whether it's one religion or the other, or all religions or no religions or a new religion, perhaps Unitarian Universalism, each of those pathways is going to have distinct benefits and distinct challenges. None of those pathways is going to make the interfaithness of the family disappear, nor should it, because I see the interfaithness as something positive. So, as a journalist, I set out in my book to chronicle one of the newest of these pathways, the one my husband and I chose for our two children, and that is the grassroots movement of interfaith families coming together to form intentional communities. According to Pew Research, some 25%, a quarter of all Jewish parents in interfaith relationships, are now raising children partly Jewish and partly something else. Apparently the something else dares not say its name. We assume that it is for the most part Christianity, although for some families it's probably UUism or secular humanism or Buddhism or increasingly Hinduism. I've been hearing from a lot of Hindus lately. But given the institutional resistance to the idea of religious double belonging, I suggest that many of these families are dual faith practitioners in a very informal home-based context. So they might be lighting Hanukkah candles and trimming Christmas trees and eating Easter ham and eating chopped liver, but many of them don't formally belong to any house of worship, nor do they have any clergy support. And I think that's a problem, because I think children need community wherever they can find it. So about 20 years ago now, interfaith families began coalescing really spontaneously across the country in order to do both religions in a more intentional way in Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, and elsewhere. And my husband and I came home from our years of travel, and we ended up in Washington, D.C., where one of these communities was already up and running. And this community would look very familiar to you and probably feel comfortable to most Unitarian Universalists. For instance, we have a great fondness for Mary Oliver and Wendell Berry, and for Dorothy Day and Rumi, and for Buber and Heschel. And to tell the truth, we have shamelessly ripped off some Unitarian Universalist traditions, including placing stones into a bowl for concerns and a flower ceremony for blessing new babies. So, as my mother once asked me, why aren't we all just Unitarians? What's the problem? So I'm going to give you some of the principal differences because I think you may find them inspiring going forward as your communities become more interfaith, as the world becomes more interfaith. My community has a rabbi and a minister on staff, working together as spiritual co-leaders and pastoral counselors. And like the other interfaith communities around the country, we also have one Jewish educator and one Christian educator working together in every classroom in order to provide wisdom from both traditions and in order to model that deep respect between the two. So, what kind of results are we getting with this system?
Can we get the left edge on? Oh, I guess that's good enough.
So very briefly, the vast majority of the children raised with both religions said that they were not confused, which has been a traditional concern. They thought their parents had made a good choice, and they wanted to raise their own children with interfaith education. One of these young people at age 17 told me, people use the term open-minded, so I like to think of interfaith as being open-souled. I liked that. That's exactly the kind of positive self-image that parents want their interfaith children to have. In terms of the results in my own family, my young adult children use an ice cream analogy to describe themselves. They're Jewish-Christian swirl with a ribbon of Buddhism. I think that sounds delicious. And I think they would make great UUs, or they may go off in a different direction. Who knows? And part of being a good interfaith parent or interfaith educator, from my point of view, is realizing that we don't control the religious identity of children as they come of age. They go out and make their own decisions, no matter what labels we've given them. Now, I want to note here that my research was primarily on Jewish and Christian families. And in the book, though, I do tell the stories of Christian and Hindu, Christian and Muslim, and Buddhist, Jewish, Christian families all raising children with dual faith education or multiple faith education. I also want to spend a minute here on children being raised with one religious and one secular parent, because that is a growing issue. Every time I go out to speak, somebody, if I don't mention it, someone will say, hey, what about this? And I'm glad to be able to refer you to an excellent new book on exactly this topic, In Faith and in Doubt, How Religious Believers and Non-Believers Can Create Strong Marriages and Happy Families, written by atheist writer Dale McGowan, who gave the Sophia Foss lecture 5 years ago before he wrote this book. Now, Dale and I agree on two really important points. We agree on a lot of points, but two that we really agree on. One is that interfaith marriages or partnerships often are successful, especially in 21st century conditions. When we no longer face the fierce opposition of extended family and clergy, there's really very little reason why an interfaith marriage can't be a success. Dale and I both concluded that most of the research claiming that interfaith families were doomed to failure is seriously flawed or outdated or was funded by people with an agenda. Another important point on which we agree is that children benefit from being introduced to the worldviews or cultures or religious beliefs of both of their parents, and that would include atheism, of course. His book is fascinating because he lives in a sort of a Bible Belt community where there are a lot of strong evangelical Christians intermarried with atheists, and somehow they're making it work. So even though I'm not either of those things, I found the book really fascinating. Now, in my own case, as an adult, I've kept the Jewish identity that my parents gave me, while at the same time reclaiming the interfaith identity that I acquired through formative experiences with extended family. And I want to note here that I do understand that for religious minorities, choosing a religious pathway other than exclusive adherence to the minority pathway can trigger fears of assimilation, of disappearance into a white American Christian minority, in the case of America. And we have parallel struggles in, say, a Muslim country with a Hindu minority, or vice versa. I have deep empathy for those fears about continuity, but based on my experience and research, I maintain that those fears should not and cannot trump the needs and rights of families or individuals to claim different or more complex identities. So, I wanted to say a couple of more words about the importance of Unitarian Universalism for me, even though it's not, or perhaps not yet, part of my claimed identity. Oh, you really can't see that, can you? It's a picture of the corner of Charles Street and Revere, and here's why. I was born in May of 1961, which happens to be the month of the great merger of Unitarianism and Universalism. And I think that this was fate somehow. I was also born on Beacon Hill, on this corner, which is just a couple of blocks from the cobblestone headquarters that was the UUA headquarters and Beacon Press in Boston. And when I was five, we moved to a suburb where the Unitarian First Parish Church had pride of place adjacent to the colonial village green. And each year, my father, who was kind of the only Jew in town, was invited to lead the model Passover Seder in the UU Sunday School. Nowadays, everybody from evangelicals to Catholics wants to get in on the Passover Seder action, right? It's pretty common. But in the 1960s, only the UUs were interested in that kind of interfaith education. And I took note of that. I'm also very aware that although my parents chose a different religious pathway for us, historically UUism has provided a really important home for interfaith families and continues to do so, for which I am profoundly grateful, because I'm not trying to get families to join my community. I'm just trying to make sure everybody has a community to belong to, whatever that may be. In fact, when interfaith couples come to me looking for a welcoming community, UU is always on my list of suggestions, especially if they live in a place where they might not have that many other options that are welcoming. And so, when I went looking for a publisher for my controversial Interfaith Families book, I already had Beacon Press in mind. And I have to say, I think Beacon Press was the only press that had the chutzpah to publish it. So, you can see why I care about UUs, but why should you care about this very small interfaith families community movement that I'm talking about? Here's why. Both UUism and interfaith families communities insist on busting binaries, challenging false dichotomies, resisting dualism, and claiming that both and rather than either or space. We share some of the terms academics have used to describe us, terms like syncretic, hybrid, mixed, and we celebrate those terms rather than seeing them as pejorative, as most traditional theologians would do. Your own Dr. Ibrahim Farajaje has called this the transmodern, transdisciplinary art of mixing it all up, the revolutionary act of the 21st century. I love that. And the world is beginning to move in this revolutionary direction. As you probably know, Pew Research recently published their religious landscape survey showing that, among other things, people who've gotten married since 2000 are about twice as likely to be in religious intermarriages as are people who got married before 1960. So which religious groups are doing all that intermarrying? We see here that it ranges from 9% among Hindus, although in second and third generation Hindu Americans, we're going to see that rate go up. And then it ranges all the way up to Buddhists, who seem to really like marrying people from other religions for whatever reason. Now, in this report, Pew did not address or acknowledge people who identified with more than one religion. But I spoke with a Pew researcher, because that's what I do. That's my journalism background. I see something, and I call the guy up, and I go, what happened to all my people that claim both? What'd you do with them? Well, he told me that they did collect data on those people, and they plan to release a report on them before the end of this year. So look for that. But all of this data begs the question, where are all of these interfaith families finding a place to sing and reflect together? Who is bringing them comfort and casseroles in times of trouble? Who's marrying them and burying them? Or to put it another way, why isn't every UU congregation overflowing with these folks who would seem to fit right in? Well, this is just one data point, but I think you might be interested in this. In my survey of over 250 interfaith parents raising kids with both religions, I asked about 30 parents who had tried UU communities why they did not stay in them. And I'll tell you that many said that their local UU community still felt too Christian to the Jewish partner. The continuing use of vocabulary such as church, reverend, ministry, mission, all of this can be challenging for interfaith families. Now, in some cases, it may not be practical or possible or desirable to erase every vestige of Christianity from a community. My point here is simply to be aware that the cumulative effect of that vocabulary creates a higher barrier for interfaith families and people with complex identities. But at the same time, the UU world is already widening the bridges between religious worlds. I want to tell you the story of Rabbi Chava Bailey, a Jewish renewal rabbi. I first became aware of her because she serves a Catholic and Jewish interfaith families community in Chicago, which is one of the communities I describe in my book. And in this community, rabbis give a Jewish blessing at the first communion for interfaith kids. And priests give a blessing at the bar and bat mitzvahs of those interfaith kids. Now, this is transformative, transgressive religious work, driven by the needs of the families rather than the needs of the institutions. And what's interesting for us here today is that currently Rabbi Chava continues to work with those interfaith families in Chicago, but she is also now the first settled rabbi to lead a UU congregation in Traverse City, Michigan. Yay. And she's an awesome speaker. You should watch her TEDx talk, and you should get her to your next GA. That's my recommendation. Now, Rabbi Chava is not the least bit ordinary. She's a beacon, so to speak, and a visionary, embodying just one of many new ways that we are living through and across religious boundaries. And I argue that all of us can and must do this work alongside her now. So what can we each of us do to ensure that we are learning from multiple religious practitioners in our midst rather than marginalizing them? I'm going to make three specific calls to action today. First, we need to have better documentation of the complexity of our religious realities. That means allowing people to check more than one box. The students you work with need to be able to check Buddhist and UU, or Jewish and atheist and UU. Nationally, we need this data to help academics and institutions to understand the growing presence of religious complexity. But also, within your world, this data would help you to understand the role of interfaith families in your own history and future. Second, we need to encourage clergy to build wider bridges. And that means we need clergy formation in every seminary that addresses ways to both support and learn from interfaith families and people with complex identities. And interfaith people need to be involved in teaching these perspectives at the seminary level. In other words, please, nothing about us without us. Now, I know many UU clergy were born into interfaith families or practice more than one religion, so it shouldn't be hard. But I also want to urge ministers and rabbis and others to work together, collaborating across religious boundaries to support interfaith families, but also support people with complex religious identities. Now, this could include, most obviously, collaborating on life cycle ceremonies, you know, the rabbi and the minister at the wedding, but also on developing interfaith curricula and on workshops or counseling to support couples or individuals who are trying to discern a religious pathway. It's very rare for couples to get access to those clergy developing, representing more than one viewpoint all at the same time. Usually they'll end up going to a minister or going to a rabbi, and they're going to get one point of view that way, and that can be problematic. And as Sophia Foss herself pointed out, this kind of multi-religious learning needs to be woven into the curriculum at all levels and not just reserved for a particular unit or for older children who have already developed their identities. Finally, the third point, we need to push for broader inclusion of interfaith families and people in traditional interfaith dialogue. We need to recognize interfaith people as highly skilled in 24/7 interfaith dialogue and invite them to tell their stories. Ironically, too often, official interfaith events actually exclude those who challenge those false binaries. Our mixed heritage inspires us to engage in interfaith activism to help counter religious intolerance, violence, and extremism. But interfaith events are often sponsored by institutions that fear that kind of blurring of boundaries. They don't really want to hear from us. So too often, as you know, official interfaith panels seem to have slots for one white male minister, one white male priest, and one white male rabbi, all of them over age 50. This kind of panel ignores UUs and millennials, by and large, and interfaith people, and all of these stories can suggest new ways forward. Back in 1948, Beacon Press published Long Ago and Many Lands, Stories for Children Told Anew, a marvelous compilation of tales from world religions collected by Sophia Foss. In the foreword, Foss wrote that these stories are, quote, different enough to attract each other, and yet fundamentally they should be so much alike that when they are brought near together, a spark is born that unites the two into one common experience. Now, I see that description of those stories as a metaphor for interfaith families. Two individuals from two or more different religions or worldviews attracted to each other, both by their differences and their similarities, create a spark that unites the two into one family experience. And my perspective as an interfaith child, albeit one with gray hair, is that neither the common experience nor the differences disappear in the next generation. Like children who have parents from two or more races or cultures, interfaith children are very aware of the complexity of their heritage and experiences and extended families, even when raised with a singular religious label. As clergy and religious educators and active UUs, you hold great power to help children to grow up to see multi-faith heritage as inspiring rather than problematic, to see it as creating a spark that will motivate them to work for religious peace. In a sense, we know that every family is an interfaith family, since no two people share identical beliefs and practices. Right? By definition. And so together, we can and must proclaim that love transcends boundaries. And with this goal in mind, I'm excited to work with UU communities as we create new ways of engaging with the multi-faith world. Inspired by liberal religious visionaries, by Emerson and Thoreau, by William Ellery Channing and Sophia Foss, we must make the leap into this new reality in which religious diversity is at the core and not just at the margins. For me, this new reality is as gorgeous as the interplay of green and gold and red leaves at Walden Pond. Together, let us open our souls and walk beneath this brilliant canopy and build this new way. Thank you. I'm sad we don't have as much time for questions because of the delay, but please come up to the mic in the center and don't be afraid to challenge me because I'm used to that and I enjoy it. This is nothing compared to speaking to 50 rabbis, which I did once. Could you come up to the mic in the center there? Yeah.
What kind of reception do you get with a Muslim audience?
There is a progressive reform Muslim movement in the US and around the world right now. I can connect people with imams who will do interfaith marriages, even when it's the woman who's the Muslim partner, which has been traditionally not allowed. So I have a lot of hope going forward that, you know, in every religion, I'm seeing movement, I'm seeing progress, I'm seeing, to some degree, it's just reckoning with the demographic reality of people intermarrying, whether these institutions want them to or not. And to some degree, I think it's a real understanding that there are benefits for the world and for the couples and for the families. So I'm going to be positive. But that's, you know, I tend to be positive.
Hi, my name is Barbara Dowdle. I'm from the Unitarian Society of Germantown. One of the reasons I would always come to this lecture at GA is that book from long ago, Many Lands, which I had in second grade in Unitarian Sunday School, I think was a guiding principle of almost everything I do today, I think. I had a fallen away Methodist father and a atheist Jewish mother, and they met in the Socialist Party, so that was their shared religion. And I recall Chaim Potok was talking about his father discovering him reading Darwin, Origin of Species, and his father got the Orthodox Jew was very upset, and Potok said he should have been more upset that he was reading Portrait of the Artist as a young man, where he learned that someone who grew up in an entirely different religion and place in the earth had so much in common with him.
Nice. Yeah, you know, Sophia Foss was doing a lot of her work in New York City, and she saw that kids in public schools were going to be sitting next to people from around the world with religions from around the world, and she felt it was important for them to learn about it, and that was pretty revolutionary. What's different now is that those kids who were sitting next to each other got married, and it's their children and grandchildren who are part of our community now. And so it's not just learning about sort of this exotic, faraway religion. It's something that kids are growing up with, going to their cousin's bar mitzvah, going to a Ramadan iftar with their cousins. Yeah.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you all that although you can't buy this book as a book anymore from the UUA bookstore, you can get it as an ebook, and very shortly it'll be posted on the UUA website as a faith development resource, a free PDF. So that's coming.
Nice. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tim Atkins. I'm a religious educator. We have a lot of interfaith families in our congregation in New Jersey, and I was wondering if you could give some more ideas about ways to support them on their spiritual journey and how to help us attract more.
Yeah. We talked about some, you were not at the professional day yesterday? Yeah. So we talked about some strategies. One is to talk to the interfaith families in your community and find out if they are double or triple belonging. Sometimes they're quiet about it. And if they have relationships with a local rabbi or imam or pandit, then connect with those clergy and work together to support the families and work with those communities to come into the classroom and take your kids to those communities. And when you're connected by family in that way, it's different than just sort of being tourists on a field trip to the temple, because you have a sort of an automatic in and a connection. As long as everybody is comfortable with it, which sometimes the clergy may not be, but if they're allowing the family to double belong, at least if they're owning up to that, then there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration in a way that's very organic, because you have these families already building the bridges. They just aren't necessarily being recognized. Now, we do have a situation where a lot of religious communities don't want families double belonging, and they know it's going on, but it's a sort of a don't ask, don't tell situation, which is not a healthy situation. But I'm working on getting some of those religious institutions to change their policies to allow education in more than one religion. But talk to some of your colleagues that were at Professional Day, and I think we can make that talk available to all of you. Yes?
When two faiths come together within a family, and at some point the realization occurs that these two stories can't both be true, is there some way to generalize as to whether that leads to a more metaphorical view of dogma, or they just tend to ignore the discrepancies, or is there some other resolution?
Good question. So the way that we present difference in our communities is to say, you know, for instance, take the topic of Jesus. We say there are many ways to look at Jesus. Some people see Jesus as a rebel rabbi, as a political figure, as a leader of a movement. Some people see him as an inspirational metaphor who may or may not have existed. Some people see him as the Son of God, and, you know, what does God mean? What does Son mean? You know, really have to pull that apart. And then, as human beings, we have the choice to adopt any of these beliefs. And we don't generalize about what a certain group thinks without speaking to the individual. So you can't make a generalization and say, if your father's Presbyterian, then he believes X about Jesus, because we don't really know what he believes. There's a tremendous diversity within Christian groups on what you would think would be fundamental dogma, like physical resurrection or virgin birth. You know, large percentages of people who adhere to those religions don't believe that. So I guess it does lead to a certain comparative way of looking, and the concern is that it's going to be therefore too intellectual and dry, but we don't find that. I mean, personally, I find metaphor inspiring of spirituality. It doesn't require me to have a sort of dogmatic belief. And we try to give our children access to spiritual experiences, say walking a labyrinth or singing in a large community. It doesn't require you to have the dogma. You know that as you use. So I'm telling you what you know. Yes, Sarah.
I'm Sarah Mills-Pye. I work in outreach for the UUA. And I come from an interfaith family and was raised UU. And one of the things I've been thinking about as you've been talking is just with couples that come together from different faiths. No, someone might be Hindu, someone might be Jewish, and they both believe in God or gods and goddesses, and they believe in a higher power. But someone might be Hindu, someone might be Jewish, and they both might be agnostics. And so how often do you see different kind, not just different religions, but people with different beliefs in God coming together, and what sorts of beliefs in God do you think or beliefs about God might be the most natural for an interfaith family coming to UUism?
You know, any of these can work. I mean, you can have a culturally Christian atheist and a culturally Jewish atheist, and they bond over their atheism. You can have one who's a believer and one who's an atheist, and it can work. I mean, read Dale McGowan's book. It kind of blew my mind, because I've sort of been working on the assumption that if you have a more fundamentalist, evangelical Christian outlook, it's going to be very hard to be in an interfaith marriage. our communities are by and large filled with people from a kind of social justice Catholic world or a mainline Protestant world or UU, and they marry Jews and it all works out somehow. But McGowan writes about these couples where you have an evangelical Christian and a secular humanist, and they're making it work. And his book actually has exercises for couples, and I think they'd be useful for anybody, not just atheist-believer combinations. So it's something that I feel like I need to do more research on, because I wrote this book over a period of 20 years, because that's how long it took basically for the world to be ready and willing to publish the book. But the rise of the religious nuns has been very dramatic and you know, only recognized recently, and it's important, and we need to look further into it, you and I and all of us. Yes.
I think I'd like to challenge you a little bit, and maybe I wasn't hearing you exactly right, but it sounded like to me that you were thinking of Unitarian Universalism as a home for a welcoming community for people of different faiths to be where they could be interfaith, as opposed to being a place of our own faith tradition, Unitarian Universalist as a faith tradition in and of itself.
Yeah, no, I was trying to address that in saying that I absolutely see the need for and the beauty of a specific UU identity. It's like any other religion has, you know, very elaborate ritual and the principles and the values, and it just happens to work really well for interfaith families. And what I'm trying to say is that I think acknowledging and affirming the interfaith families in your midst is going to ultimately benefit even UU identity as a very specific thing, and as a beautiful thing. Because I think historically, interfaith families have been playing into it all along. You see kind of, I see the traces of it in the principles, in the curricula, but I don't think necessarily all the time there's enough space. And it's partly that I think if you want to capture more of the people from this spiritual but not religious, religious nuns categories, then these are some ways to do it, to lower that barrier that feels more Christian to a lot of people from non-Christian backgrounds. But I'm not telling you what to do. If you don't want to do that, that's fine with me. You've got an amazing thing going. I was at the opening ceremonies, you know, thousands of people. It's very robust, and it's actually one of the more robust religious denominations right now. It's, I believe, growing where a lot are shrinking. So you're doing a lot of things right, that's for sure, and I'm not here to say otherwise. But I think there are ways. To me, being part of an interfaith family is a positive thing, and you've got a lot of them here, and I'm just trying to lift them up and say, I think there's ways you all would benefit, and I don't think it's in conflict with that idea of UU identity and specificity. Yeah.
Hi. I'm asking for advice as a brand new grandparent. My ex-wife was Jewish by birth and was more or less in synagogues maybe twice a year. My children were raised in the Reform synagogue. During college, my son became enamored of the Chabad organization, which is very evangelical, yeah, very Hasidic, and is now a full-strength, black hat Hasidic Jew who follows maybe 633 religious rules for living. So we were just out looking for books for our new grandchild. There can be no frogs, there can be no bears, there can be, most animals are not kosher. So I'm just wondering if you have any advice about how to talk to a son who is going to deprive my grandchild of Goodnight Moon and Berenstain Bears and Curious George, all the things that we loved as children and loved reading to our children.
Wow, yeah, that's hard. You might benefit from reading this book. He's definitely not going to want to read it, so don't try that. You know, a lot of interfaith parents, when we ask them, you know, how do you want your children to end up religiously, they'll often say, I don't care as long as it's not something really orthodox. And this is exactly what happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we don't have control. Mm-hmm. They're on a lifelong journey. None of us end up anything until we die. So who knows what can happen. That said, these books, which are all beloved to me, are part of our cultures. There are beautiful books, children's books. Look at PJ Library. Are you aware of that?
No.
PJ Library will send free Jewish children's books to any Jewish child in America. And it's like a book of the month thing. It's pretty exciting because I think every month they get new books in the mail. Check that out if they're not already getting it. At least you get to be the fun grandpa that gave them some books, and they should all, I assume they're kosher for Chabad level. I'm not sure because it's a program that spans Reform to Orthodox. They'll send them to anybody. But take a look at that. I know that's not really consolation, but there's many beautiful ways to weave relationships with grandchildren. And sometimes we do have to let go of some of what is cultural that may not work, because the parents do have the right to determine what is the religious upbringing of that child, at least until the child is 18. Mm-hmm. Then anything goes. Anyone else? We should stop because I want to leave time for if anybody wants to. Do we have books? Yes, in the back. There are books for sale in the back, and I'm going to scurry back there in case anybody wants to have one signed. If you have to run off right now, you can also buy the book in the UUA bookstore in the exhibit hall, and I will be available starting at 4:34:45 in the Lareda booth at the exhibit hall until, say, 5:30 today, and I can chat with you there and sign books there if you buy them there. And I'll be at the Lareda booth again tomorrow from 10 to 11 a.m. Thank you.
Yeah, and it'll take that.
Thank you. coming, but it just... Sweetie. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. I will come and turn it on and do my magic. This mic is already live, so I can't say anything I shouldn't say, right?
Well, unless you paid for the microphone.
There's that.